It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, NASA announced this week the Kepler spacecraft mission has discovered nearly 1,300 more planets. Yes, nearly 1,300 more in addition to what it's already discovered. This brings Kepler's total to more than 2,000 planets discovered. Joining me now, as he has in the past with other major Kepler announcements, someone who has long been associated with the Kepler mission, Steve Kowaler is an astronomy professor at Iowa State University. Hello again, Steve.
Hi, Ben.
Remind us quickly, what is Kepler all about? What does it set out to do?
Kepler's role is to find planets around other stars, as many as possible in a finite volume of space so that we can figure out how many planets there are all over.
Okay, so tell us about these newly discovered planets, to 1,284, according to my notes.
That sounds almost right. The Kepler mission had already found over 1,000 planets, and as we find more and more planets, or more and more candidates, planets in the Kepler data, it gets harder and harder to confirm that they are planets and not some sort of background astrophysical process. So we want to be sure that the signal that we're seeing, this little tiny drop in the light from a star, is caused indeed by a planet crossing in front of it. What makes this recent slew of detections or confirmations so special is that it was done with a new technique. The technique involves using what we've already learned from the previous Kepler discoveries to reduce the chance that what we're seeing is misidentified as a planet. So it's a new statistical technique based on what we've learned about what planets actually do look like around other stars that has given us the confidence to call these new 1,280 or so detections actual planets.
Okay, so these 1,280 and these other 1,000 or so that Kepler has discovered, are they spread out across the sky, or are they in one narrow band or patch in the sky?
They're confined to a fairly narrow patch, about the size of your fist, if you hold your fist up to the sky, make sure no one else is looking. That's about the size of the sky that Kepler looked at for a little over 4 years. And all of the Kepler discoveries have been in that one small patch of the sky.
So in that small patch, there are thousands of planets there. So that has significance when we talk about the entire sky, where we are in this universe.
Absolutely. Kepler is only looking at a tiny fraction of the number of stars in the whole Milky Way galaxy. In fact, it carefully monitored only 150,000 stars. And amongst those 150,000 stars, it's found well over 2,000 planets now.
Mm-hmm. So the first indication that there may be a planet there, which you said is a planet candidate, is when there's a tiny, tiny dimming of light in front of a star that is very far away from us, detected by Kepler.
Right, right. The dip is a few parts per million in the light coming from the star.
Okay, so we have that as the first indication, and then that makes it a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And then what turns it from a candidate into an actual planet?
Well, first you want to see the dip again. A single dip is rarely conclusive, but if you see two or three dips and they're equally spaced in time, then the chances are good that the dips are caused by something going around that star periodically, like the Earth goes around the Sun. The next step is, if you've got that candidate, you have to make sure it's not something else that Kepler is looking at very close to the star that you think you're looking at. So you want to make sure that the signal's coming from the star that you're targeting and not a background star that could be doing something that stars often do, which is change their brightness periodically.
Mm-hmm. So tell me then, based on that little dip and then reconfirming it, what can you tell about the actual planet from that dip in light?
It's really remarkable how much you can tell from a simple transit, from a simple drop in the light and then a bounce back up. You can determine the size of the planet, the radius of the planet. You can determine the time that it takes to orbit the star, the speed in its orbit around the star. Things you can tell that you would like to know is the mass of the planet and the composition. But just simply from watching those dips, you can get almost everything you need to know about the orbit and the size.
Mm-hmm. So with these thousands of planets discovered, over 2,000. How many of them are possibly Earth-like in the Goldilocks zone, which we've talked about earlier?
Well, that's still somewhat of an open question, a small fraction of the ones that we've seen. The numbers range from 20 to 50 in terms of planets that are at just the right distance from their star, that they're not baked completely by the heat from the star, and they're not frozen by being too far away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within that subset, if you want a planet like the Earth, on which life could develop, you don't want the planet to be too massive, like Jupiter, or too tiny like the moon. And so the number of planets of the right size in the right place is of order 20.
Mm-hmm. So you've said before, as we've talked about Kepler, that you believe, based on what Kepler has found, that there's life out there somewhere in our galaxy. Does this new set of data change anything for you?
It just makes me feel more confident in that feeling. The more planets we find, the more Earth-like planets we find in this one sample of 150,000, the greater the chances of finding a nice, comfortable Earth-like planet, not necessarily in the Kepler part of the sky, but somewhere in our galaxy.
Mm-hmm. So there's something called the TESS mission that NASA has, meant to search for planets around nearby bright stars. Tell us about that.
Well, the TESS mission is in some sense a follow-on to Kepler. Kepler looked at this one tiny patch of sky, well, not so tiny patch of sky, but it looked at very, very faint stars. The planets that we found around those stars, we can't really characterize very well because you need an enormous telescope to do that. TESS is going to look all over the sky, everywhere that you can imagine except where Kepler looked, to try and find planets around much brighter stars. If we're successful in doing that, and we should be, there's about 500,000 stars in the catalog that we're going to be looking at, then we'll be able to use ground-based telescopes and the next generation of space-based telescopes to look at the atmospheres of those newly discovered planets and look for signs of life in the atmospheres. So TESS is sort of the next logical step, not just find ET's home, but find ET's home in places that we can actually study.
So end of the semester at Iowa State University, heading off into the summer. What does the research mean for you in the summertime?
Well, in the summer, I get to actually dig into Kepler data and data from the K2 mission, which was the follow-on to this initial planet search. So I've got a ton of data that's been stacking up on my computer that I'll be able to look through this summer and try and learn a little bit about the stars, not necessarily planet host stars, but other stars.
Okay, so I'm trying to picture what that looks like, data stacking up on your computer. So you've got this data. Now, what are you looking for? What are you looking at? What process do you use?
Well, I'm looking at the measurements of the stars that Kepler and K2 have made. The brightness is a function of time, not looking for these tiny dips so much, but by looking for periodic variations, the things that we might mistake for planets. That tells us a lot about what the structure of the stars are. We're doing basically looking for star quakes to see if we can probe the insides of the stars by how they oscillate.
Uh-huh. Okay. So your mind's way out there in the universe trying to describe it in a better way than we have so far in human history. Does that change your enjoyment of the summer? Do you you like the same things we do?
Well, it's just another day at work, right? No, there are other things I like to do during the summer as well. We were chatting off air about bicycling, and that's something I really do enjoy.
Mm-hmm. But I guess I mean being aware of how vast, having a better comprehension of most of us of what our universe may contain. Does that change anything about the way you go about your life?
Well, ever since I was a kid, I knew that the universe was inscrutable, that there were things out there that we really couldn't imagine. And so exploring it and finding new and exciting things, that's kind of what you expect in this field. That said, there are still discoveries that just knock your socks off. And having a little bit of an insight into the details about how this work does gives you even a better appreciation, I think, for how amazing our universe is and really how good a job we're doing as a species in exploring it.
Okay. Steve Kowaler, astronomy professor at Iowa State University. We'll look forward to the next installment of what's out there in our universe.
Thank you.